upon vigorous young soldiers. If the two guards hadn't been mentally paralyzed, they would undoubtedly have held their own against those unathletic officers. As it was, they were butchered within seconds. Great Lady Holy lowered herself into Jeevita's chair. She ignored the three bodies and the pools of blood spreading across the platform.
"Call off this insane attack," she commanded. "At once, Great Lady Holy," cried Achyuta.
He glanced at one of his subordinates. An instant later, the man was scrambling down the ladder. Reluctantly, Achyuta came to stand before the old woman. Reluctantly, for he knew that the aged figure hunched on that chair was only an old woman in form. Within that crone's body dwelt the spirit called Link. He feared that spirit as much as he was awed by it.
"Describe the damage."
Achyuta didn't even try to calculate the casualty figures. Link, he knew, would be utterly indifferent. Instead, he went straight to the heart of the problem.
"Without the supply fleet, we cannot take Babylon."
He glanced toward the Euphrates. The sunset was almost gone, but the river was still well illuminated by the multitude of burning ships.
"Under the best of circumstances, we've been set back."
He hesitated, quailing before summoning his courage. Link, he knew, would punish dishonesty faster than anything. In this, at least, the divine spirit was utterly unlike Jeevita. Mindless rages were not Link's way. Simply cold, cold, cold. He cleared his throat.
"Until next year," he concluded.
A human would have cocked an eye, or something. Link simply stared at Achyuta through those empty old woman's eyes.
"So long?"
Again he cleared his throat.
"Yes, Great Lady Holy. Until we can replace the destroyed ships, we will only have sufficient supplies to maintain the siege. There will be no chance of pressing home any attacks, and we have..."
He waved his hand helplessly, gesturing toward the invisible barrenness of the region.
"We have no way to build ships here. They will have to be built in India and brought here during the monsoon next year."
Great Lady Holy, Link, was silent. The old woman's eyes were still empty, but Achyuta could sense the lightning-quick calculations behind those orbs.
"Yes, you are correct. But that is not the worst of it."
The last sentence had something of the sense of a question about it. Achyuta nodded vigorously.
"No, Great Lady Holy, it isn't. There will be no point in bringing a new fleet of supply ships if the river..."
Again, that helpless gesture. Great Lady Holy filled the silence.
"We must restore the river. They have dammed it upstream. An expedition must be sent at once to destroy the dam and the force which built it."
"At once," agreed Achyuta. "I will assemble the force tomorrow. I will lead it myself." Great Lady Holy levered herself upright.
"No, Lord Achyuta, you will not lead it. You will remain here in charge of the siege. Appoint one of your subordinates to command the expedition."
Achyuta didn't even think to argue the matter. He nodded his head vigorously, asked in a tone which was almost fawning,
"Which one, Great Lady Holy, do you have a preference?"
The divine spirit glanced around the platform, estimating the officer standing there rigidly. It was a quick, quick glance.
"It does not matter. I will accompany the expedition personally. Whoever it is will obey me."
Achyuta's eyes widened.
"You? You yourself? But..."
He fell silent under the inhuman stare.
"I can trust no one else, Achyuta. This was Belisarius's work. His, and the one who goes with him."
She turned away.
"I know my enemy now. I will destroy it myself."
Moments later, assisted by the hands of several officers, the figure of the old woman disappeared down the ladder. Achyuta was relieved to see her go. So relieved, in fact, that he didn't wonder for more than an instant why Great Lady Holy had referred to the man Belisarius as it. Personal peeve, he assumed, not thinking that the divine spirit named Link was never motivated by such petty concerns. The next morning, from his perch atop the hill which had once been the Tower of Babel, Emperor Khusro watched the Malwa Expeditionary Force begin their march to Peroz Shapur and the Nahar Malka. The sight was impressive. There were at least 60,000 soldiers in that army across the Euphrates. At the moment, from what he could see, Khusrow thought the enemy force was infantry heavy. But he had no doubt that they would be joined along the march by the mounted raiding parties which the Malwa had kept in the field ravaging Mesopotamia. By the time that army reached its destination, he estimated its numbers would have swelled by at least another 10,000. Most of the Malwa army's supplies were being carried on camelback, but the expedition was also accompanied by small oared warships which were being laboriously portaged past Babylon. Those vessels would have a shallow enough draft to negotiate the Euphrates upstream. The water level of the river had dropped drastically, but it was still a respectable stream. He could see no siege guns. He would have been surprised to have done so. Weeks earlier, Belisarius had explained to him that heavy guns, even sectioned, require carts, or better, barges for transport. Barges would be too heavy for the shrunken river, and as for carts, how to haul them? Camels make poor draft animals, and horses couldn't manage a long and heavy-loaded march through the desert. There was no way to haul carts along the river itself, of course. The terrain directly adjoining the Euphrates was much too marshy, even more so now that the water level had dropped. No, he thought with satisfaction, it is just as Belisarius predicted. They will be restricted to rockets and grenades, weapons which they can carry on camelback. Without taking his eyes from the Malwa army, the Persian emperor cocked his head toward the man standing at his side.
You are certain, Morris? It is still not too late. I can order a sally against that force.
Morris shook his head.
That would be unwise, Your Majesty.
With only the slightest trace of apology.
If you forgive me saying so.
Morris pointed to the south. Even at the distance, it was obvious that the main force of the enemy was mobilized and ready.
They're hoping for that. They'll be prepared today. They've erected their own pontoon bridges across the river. If you make another sally, they'll overwhelm you.
Khusrow did not pursue the matter further. In truth, he agreed with Morris. He had made the offer simply out of a sense of obligation. He owed much to the Romans, and he was a man who detested being in debt. Inwardly, he sighed. He wouldn't be able to repay that debt for some time, if ever. Once again, circumstances forced him to allow his allies to fight for him. The great Malwa expeditionary force would have no Persians to contend with other than Kurush's 10,000 men, and those troops would be needed to defend Peroz Shapur, which the Malwa expedition would bypass on its way to the Nahar Malka. Kurush and his men would tie up at least their own number of enemy troops, true, but they would be unavailable to help in the defense of the dam itself. Once again, Belisarius would fight for him, almost unaided. A sour thought came. Except, of course, for the aid of a traitor. Khusrow squared his shoulders. The foul deed needed to be done. He wouldn't postpone it. He turned to one of his aides. Send for Ormazd, he commanded. As the officer trotted away, Khusrow grimaced. Then, seeing the slight smile on Morris's face, he grimaced even more. And this, Morris? Are you also certain of this? The Roman Kiliarch shrugged.
If you want my personal opinion, Your Majesty, no. I am not certain. I suspect that Belisarius is being too clever for his own good.
Scowl.
As usual.
The scowl faded.
But I have thought so before, and though I never admit it to his face, been proven wrong before.
Again, he shrugged.
So, best to stick to his plan. Maybe he'll be right again.
Khusrow nodded. For the next few minutes, as they waited for Ormazd to make his appearance, the Persian emperor and the Roman officer stood together in silence. Morris spent the time in a careful study of the enemy's expeditionary army. He would be leaving himself the next day to rejoin the Roman army awaiting the Malwa onslaught at the Nahar Malka. Belisarius would want a full and detailed description of his opponent's forces. Khusrow, on the other hand, spent the time in a careful study of Morris. Not of the man so much as what he represented. It might be better to say what the man Morris told him of the general he followed. Told the Persian emperor not by any words he spoke, but by his very nature. Belisarius. Khusrow had spent many hours thinking about Belisarius in the past weeks. Belisarius, the ally of the present. Belisarius, the possible enemy of the future. Khusrow was himself a great leader. He knew that already, despite his youth. Part of that greatness was due to his capacity to examine reality objectively, unswayed by self-esteem and personal grandiosity. No small feat, that, for an emperor of Iran and non-Iran. And so Khusro knew that one of the qualities of a great leader was his ability to gather around him other men of talent. He had never seen such a collection of capable men as Belisarius had cemented together in his army's leadership. He admired that team, envied Belisarius for it, and feared it at the same time. Crude men, true, low-born almost to a man. Men like Maurice himself, for instance, whom Khusro knew had been born a peasant. But the Persian emperor was a great emperor, and so he wasn't blinded by his own class prejudices. Pure-blood empires had been brought down before by low-born men. The day could come in the future when the peasant-bred Maurice might stand again on that very hilltop, not as an ally, but a conqueror. On that hill in Babylon, on the walls of Ctesiphon, on the horse pastures of the Heartland Plateau. So while they waited for Ormazd and Maurice gave thought to the near future, the emperor of Iran and non-Iran gave thought to the more distant future. By the time his treacherous half-brother finally made his appearance, Khusro had decided on a course of action. He would outrage Aryan opinion, but he shrugged that problem off. With Ormazd removed, Khusro did not fear the squawks of Aryan nobility. He trusted Belisarius to remove Ormazd for him, and he would entrust the future of his empire to an alliance with that same man. Ormazd's progress up the slope of the hill was stately, as much due to his horde of sycophants as to his own majestic pace. So Khusro had time to lean over and whisper to Maurice, "Tonight I wish to see you in my pavilion." Maurice nodded. When Ormazd was finally standing before the emperor, Khusro pointed to the Malwa expedition making its own slow way across the river. "Tomorrow, brother, you will take your army and join the allied forces at the Nahar Malka. You will give Beresmenus and Belisarius all the assistance you can provide in their coming battle against that enemy force." Ormazd scowled. "I will not take orders from a Roman," he snapped. "Nor from Beresmenus, for that matter. I am higher born than—" Khusro waved him down. "Of course not, brother, but it is I, not they, who is commanding you in this. I leave it to your judgment how best to assist Belisarius once you arrive. You will be in full command of your own troops, but you will assist them." His half-brother's scowl deepened. Khusro's own expression grew fierce. "You will obey your emperor," he hissed. Ormazd said nothing. Put that way, there was nothing he could say unless he was prepared to rise in open rebellion that very moment, which he most certainly wasn't. Not in the middle of Khusro's main army. Not after his own prestige had suffered such a battering during the past 2 months. After a moment, grudgingly, Ormazd nodded. He muttered a few phrases which charitably could be taken for words of obedience, and quickly made his exit. Later that night, when Maurice arrived at the emperor's pavilion, he was ushered into Khusro's private chamber. As he entered, Khusro was sitting at a small table occupied with writing a letter. The emperor glanced up, smiled, and gestured toward a nearby cushion. "Please sit, Maurice. I'm almost finished." After Maurice took his seat, a servant appeared through a curtain and presented him with a goblet of wine. Before Maurice could even take a sip, Khusro rose from the table and embossed the letter with the seal ring which is one of the Persian emperor's insignia of office. With no apparent signal being given, a man immediately appeared in the chamber and took the missive from the emperor. A moment later, he was gone. Maurice, watching, was impressed but not surprised. Persia had always been famous for the efficiency of its royal postal system. The man who took the letter to its destination was known as a Parvanak, and it was one of the most prestigious positions in the imperial Persian hierarchy. In contrast, the Roman equivalent, the agentes in rebus, were more in the way of spies than postal officials. Which might be good for imperial control, thought Maurice sourly, but it makes for piss-poor delivery of the mail. As soon as they were alone in the room, Khusro took a seat on his own resplendent cushion. "Tell me about the Emperor Phocius," he commanded, "Belisarius's son." Maurice was puzzled by the question, but he let no sign of it show.
"He's not really his son, Your Majesty. His stepson."
Khusro smiled. "His son, I think." Maurice stared at the emperor for a moment, then nodded. It was a deep nod, almost a bow, in fact.
"Yes, Your Majesty, his son."
Tell me about him.
Morris studied the Persian, still puzzled. Understanding, Khusro smiled again. Perhaps I should give my question more of a focus. He rose and strode over to one side of his chamber. Drawing aside the curtain, he called out a name. A moment later, moving with stiff and shy uncertainty, a young girl entered the chamber. Morris estimated her age at 13, perhaps 14. The daughter of a high Persian nobleman, obviously, and very beautiful.
This is Tahmina, said Khusro. She is the oldest daughter of Beresminus, the noblest man of the noble Seren.
With a gesture, Khusro invited the girl to sit on a nearby cushion. Tahmina did so quickly and with a surprising grace for one so young.
My own children are very young, said Khusro. Then, with a little laugh, besides, they're all boys.
The emperor turned and bestowed an odd look on Morris. Morris, at least, thought the look was odd. He was now utterly bewildered as to the emperor's purpose.
Beresminus cherishes his daughter, said Khusro sternly. Then, even more sternly, as do I myself, for that matter.
Beresminus placed her in my care when he left for Constantinople with his wife. She is an absolutely delightful child, and I have enjoyed her company immensely. It has made me look forward to having daughters of my own someday. The emperor began pacing back and forth. She is of good temper and intelligent. She is also, as you can see for yourself, very beautiful. He stopped abruptly. So, tell me about the Roman Emperor Photius. Morris's eyes widened. His jaw almost dropped.
He's only 8 years old, he choked.
The gesture which Khusro made in response to that statement could only have been made by an emperor. August dismissal of an utterly trivial matter. He will age, pronounced the emperor. Soon enough, he will need a wife. Again, the stern look. So, tell me about the Emperor Photius. I do not ask for anything but your personal opinion of the boy himself, Morris. You will say he is a child, and I will respond that the child is father to the man. Tell me about the man, Photius. For just a moment, Khusro's imperial manner faltered. The girl is very dear to me, you see. I would not wish to see her abused. Morris groped for words. Hesitated, vacillated, jittered back and forth in his mind. He was floundering in waters much too deep for him. Imperial waters, for the sake of Christ. Then, as his eyes roamed about, they happened to meet those of Tahmina. Shy eyes. Uncertain eyes. Fearful eyes. That, Morris understood. He took a deep breath. When he spoke, his voice had more in it than usual of the Thracian accent of his peasant upbringing.
A good lad he is, your majesty. A sweet-tempered boy, not nasty-spirited in the least. Bright, too, I think. It's a bit early to tell yet, of course. Precocious lads, which he is, sometimes fritter it all away as they get too sure of themselves. But Photius, no, I think not.
He stopped, bringing himself up short.
I really shouldn't say anything more, he announced. It's not my place.
Khusro's eyes bore into him.
Damn all that, he snapped. I only want the answer to a simple question. Would you marry your daughter to him?
Morris started to protest that he had no daughter, not that he knew of, at least. But the sight of Tahmina's eyes stilled the words. That he understood. That he could answer.
Oh, yes, he whispered. Oh, yes.
Chapter 28. Alexandria, autumn, 531 AD. As her ships approached the great harbor of Alexandria, Antonina began to worry that her entire fleet might capsize. It seemed to her at a glance that the soldiers on every one of her ships were crowding the starboard rails, eager for a look at the world-famous Pharos. The great lighthouse was perched on a small island, also called Pharos, which was connected to the mainland by an artificial causeway known as the Heptastadium. The causeway, in addition to providing access to the lighthouse, also served to divide the great harbor from the Onastis harbor on the west. Built in three huge stories, the Pharos towered almost 400 feet high. The lowest section was square in design, the second octagonal, and the third cylindrical. At the very top of the cylindrical structure was a room in which a great fire was kept burning at all hours of the day and night.
The light produced by that fire was magnified and projected to seaward by a reflecting device. At night, the light could be seen for a tremendous distance. She and her troops had seen that light only a few hours earlier, as her fleet approached Alexandria in the early hours of the morning. Now, 2 hours after dawn, the beam seemed pallid. But in the darkness, the light of the Pharos had truly lived up to its reputation. And now that they could see it clearly, so did the lighthouse itself. Her soldiers were absolutely packing the starboard rails. Antonina was on the verge of issuing orders, futile ones, probably, when a cry from the lookout in the bow drew her attention.
"Ships approaching," he bellowed. "Drummonds! 8 Drummonds!"
She scrambled down the ladder from the poop deck and hurried along the starboard catwalk to the bow. Within a minute, she was standing alongside the lookout, peering at the small fleet which was emerging from the great harbor. 8 Drummonds, just as he had said. 5 of them were full size, the other 3 somewhat smaller. In all, she estimated that there were at least 1,500 soldiers manning those Drummonds. Most of them were oarsmen, but after a quick count, she decided there were well over 400 Marines aboard as well. Armed and armored. And the oarsmen would also have weapons ready to hand in the event of a boarding action. And she watched 7 of the Drummonds spread out, forming a barrier across the entrance to the great harbor. The 8th, one of the smaller ones, began rowing toward her. She felt someone at her elbow. Turning her head, she saw that Hermogenes had joined her, along with 2 of his tribunes and the captain of her flagship.
"What are your orders?" asked the captain.
"Stop the ship," she said, "and signal the rest of the fleet to do likewise."
A pained look came on the captain's face, but he obeyed instantly.
"What did I say wrong this time?" grumbled Antonina.
Hermogenes chuckled. "Don't know. I'm not a seaman either. But I'm sure you don't just stop a ship, much less a whole fleet. That's way too logical and straightforward. Probably something like belay all forward progress and relay the signal for all ships to emulate execution."
Smiling, Antonina resumed her study of the approaching Drummond. The warship was 200 yards away now. "I assume that Drummond is bearing envoys."
"From whom?" he asked.
Antonina shrugged. "We'll find out soon enough."
She pushed herself away from the rail.
"When they arrive, usher them into my cabin. I'll wait for them there."
Hermogenes nodded. "Good idea. It'll make you seem more imperial than if you met them on deck."
"The hell with that," muttered Antonina. "It'll make me seem taller. I had that chair in my cabin specially designed for it."
Ruefully, she looked down at her body.
"As short as I am, I can't intimidate anybody standing up."
As she hurried down the catwalk toward her cabin, Antonina noted that the appearance of the 8 Drummonds had at least had the salutary effect of eliminating the danger of capsizing her ships. The soldiers of her fleet had left off their sightseeing and were taking up battle positions. She stopped for a moment, steadying herself against a stay. Now that Antonina's fleet had come to a halt, the flagship was wallowing in the waves, drifting slowly before the wind. The sea was calm that morning, however, and the wind not much more than a light breeze. The ship's motion was gentle. Searching the sea for John's gunship, Antonina spotted the Theodora within seconds. To her satisfaction, she saw that John was already tacking to the northwest. In the event of a conflict, the gunship would be in perfect position to sail downwind toward the Drummonds blocking the harbor. A shout came to meet her.
"There'll be several envoys from that ship," she pointed to the Drummond, "coming aboard. Hermogenes will usher them into my cabin. I want you and—"
She broke off, studying the officers in the oncoming warship.
"Taking account, to be precise.
And 4 of your cataphracts to be there with me," she concluded. Ashot smiled rather grimly.
"Any in particular?"
Antonina's returning smile was just as grim.
"Yes. The 4 biggest, meanest, toughest ones you've got."
Ashot nodded. Before Antonina had taken 3 paces toward her cabin, the Armenian officer was already bellowing his commands.
"Synesius, Matthew, Leo, Xenophilus, front and center!"
The first thing the visiting officers did after Hermogenes ushered them in was to study the 4 cataphracts standing in each corner of Antonina's large cabin. A careful study lasting for at least 30 minutes. Antonina fought down a grin. The visiting officers reminded her of nothing so much as 4 sinners in the antechamber of hell examining the denizens of the pit. 4 devils, 1 in each corner.
Counting arms and armor, Antonina estimated their collective gross weight at 1,200 pounds. Two of the cataphracts were so tall their helmets were almost brushing the ceiling of the cabin. One of them was so wide he looked positively deformed. And the last one, Leo, was considered by all of Belisarius's Bucellarii to be the ugliest man alive. Not cute ugly, not pug-nosed bulldog ugly. Ugly, ugly. Rabid, vicious, slavering monster ugly. Ogre ugly. Troll ugly. Even when Leo wasn't scowling, which at the moment he most certainly was. A gut-wrenching, spine-freezing, bowel-loosening Moloch kind of scowl. Antonina cleared her throat, demurely, ladylike. "What can I do for you, gentlemen?" she asked. The officer in the forefront tore his eyes away from Leo and stared at her. He was a middle-aged man with graying hair and a beard streaked with white. He was actually a bit on the tall side, Antonina thought, but he looked like a midget in the same room with Ashot's four cataphracts. For a moment, the man's stare was simply blank. Then, as recognition came to him, his eyes narrowed. "You are the woman Antonina?" he demanded. "The wife of Belisarius?" She nodded. The officer's lips tightened. "We have been told, that is to say, it is our understanding, that you have been appointed in charge of this, fleet." She nodded. The officer's lips grew thinner still, as if he had just tasted the world's sourest lemon. "The situation here in Alexandria is very complicated," the officer stated forcefully. "You must understand that. It will do no one any good if you simply charge into—" "The situation in Egypt is not complicated," interrupted Antonina. "The situation is very simple. The former civil, ecclesiastical, and military authorities have lost the confidence of the emperor and the empress regent. For that reason, I have been sent here to oversee their replacement by people who enjoy the imperial trust. On board this fleet are the newly designated Praetorian Prefect, Patriarch, and the Mararch of the Army of Egypt." She pointed a finger at Hermogenes. The young Mararch was leaning his shoulder into a nearby wall, the very figure of casual relaxation. "Him, as it happens. May I introduce you?" The four naval officers were goggling at her. Antonina smiled sweetly and added, "I will also be glad to introduce you to the new Praetorian Prefect and Patriarch as soon as possible, but I'm afraid they're not on this ship." One of the younger officers in the rear suddenly exploded. "This is absurd. You can't—" "I most certainly can. I most certainly will." The same officer began to speak again, but the older officer in the forefront hushed him with an urgent wave of the hand. "We agreed that I would do the talking," he hissed, turning his head a bit. When he looked back at Antonina, his lips had disappeared entirely. The lemon had been swallowed whole. "I can see you are not open to reason," he snapped, "so I will speak plainly. The naval authorities in Alexandria, of which we are the representatives, will take no sides in the disputes which are roiling the city, but we must insist that those disputes be settled by the city itself. We cannot agree, we will not agree, to the imposition of a forcible solution by outsiders. Therefore—" "Arrest them," said Antonina. "All four." She spoke softly, calmly, easily. The officers gaped. One of them reached for his sword. But before he could begin to draw the blade from its scabbard, a hand clamped around his wrist like a vice. Xenophilus's hand that was about the size of a bear's paw. The other huge hand seized the officer by the back of the neck. The officer began to shout. Xenophilus squeezed. The man stopped shouting instantly, began to turn blue, in fact. The other three officers were likewise pinioned, wrist and neck, by the rest of Ashot's cataphracts. "You can't do this," shrieked the one in Matthew's grip. Matthew was one of the cataphracts who almost had to stoop to clear the cabin's ceiling. He grinned cheerfully and squeezed. Silence. "Why not?" asked Antonina, smiling like a seraph. She made a little gesture at Matthew. The cataphract eased up the pressure on his captive's throat. The man coughed explosively. Then, gasping, "Those Dramans have orders. If we don't return within an hour, they're to assume that hostilities have commenced." "Hostilities have commenced," mused Hermogenes. "My, that sounds ominous." He glanced at Ashot, leaning against the opposite wall in an identical pose. "Hostilities have commenced," echoed the Armenian cataphract. "Dire words." With a little thrust of his shoulder, Ashot stood erect. He and Hermogenes exchanged a smile.
"Dreadful words," said Ashot. "I believe I may defecate."
The officer who had issued the threat snarled.
"Make light of it if you will, but I remind you that those are 8 warships. What do you have besides those grain ships and that horde of Corbitas? 2 dromans, that's it."
"Not quite," murmured Ashot.
He swiveled his head, looking at Antonina. She nodded. Ashot walked out of the cabin. Seconds later, his voice was heard. "Send a signal to Theodora. The blue and white flag followed by the red." A moment later, he ambled back inside the cabin.
"That means hostilities have commenced," he explained to the 4 arrested officers. Then, grinning, "in a manner of speaking."
The captives were so busy staring at Ashot that they never heard Antonina's little murmur.
"Cross the T, to be precise, and fire broadside."
Aboard the Theodora, John of Rhodes and Eusebius were standing on the poop deck. Seeing the blue and white pennant followed by the red, John whooped.
"Yes, at last! Now we'll see what this beautiful bitch can do."
"Wouldn't let the Empress hear you say that if I were you," muttered Eusebius.
The artificer was standing next to John, clutching the rail. His face was drawn and pale. The Theodora's tacking against the wind had awakened Eusebius's always latent seasickness.
"Why not?" demanded John cheerfully. "The ship's named after her, isn't it? Isn't the Empress a beauty? Isn't she just the world's meanest bitch?"
Gaily, he slapped Eusebius on the shoulder.
"But she's our bitch, boy. Ours."
John pointed to the ladder leading to the deck below.
"Get on down now, Eusebius. I want you keeping a close eye on those overenthusiastic gunners."
Making his way gingerly down the ladder, Eusebius heard John bellowing to his sailors and steersmen.
"Head for that fleet of dromans across the harbor. I want to sail right across their bows."
When Eusebius reached the gun deck, he headed to the starboard side of the ship. On the Theodora's new heading, northwest to southeast, she would be bringing the 5 cannons on that side to bear on the enemy. Soon enough, Eusebius forgot his seasickness. He was utterly preoccupied with the task of preparing the cannons for a broadside. He scampered up and down the gun deck, fretting over every detail of the work. For once, the Syrian gunners and their wives didn't curse him for a fuss budget and mock him for an impractical philosopher. This wasn't an exercise. This was the real thing. They would not be firing at empty barrels tossed overboard. They would be firing at frontline warships, which would be attacking them. True, those warships had no cannons, but the word Drummond meant racer, and the sleek naval craft positioned at the entrance to the great harbor lived up to the term. Beautifully designed, elegant, in fact, as no tubby sailing ship ever was, they reminded the Syrian gunners of so many gigantic wasps ready to strike in an instant. Long, narrow, deadly. By the time the Theodora was halfway to the Drummonds, the gunners had the cannons loaded and ready to fire. They were very familiar with the process now due to the relentless training exercises which Eusebius had insisted upon during the weeks of their voyage. They had resented those exercises at the time. The Theodora's gunners were all volunteers from the Theodoran cohort. When the posts had been opened, the bidding had been fierce. Most of the Syrian grenadiers had wanted those prestigious jobs. Prestigious, and they had all assumed, easy, certainly compared to the work of toting grenades and hand cannons under the hot sun of Egypt. Lounging about on a ship, never walking more than a few steps, what could be better? They had soon learned otherwise. Within a week of setting sail from Rhodes, they had become the butt of the cohort's jokes. The rest of the grenadiers had lolled against the rails of their transports, watching while the gunners were put through their drills, watching and grinning day after day as the gunners sweated under the Mediterranean sun. Not as hot as Egypt's, that sun, but it was hot enough. Especially for men and women who practiced hauling brass cannons to the gun ports, lugging ammunition and shot forward from the hold, loading the guns, firing them, and then doing it all over again. Time after time, hour after hour, day after day. All of it under the watchful eye of a man who, by temperament, would have made an excellent monk. The kind of monk who vigilantly oversees the work of other monks, copying page after page of manuscript, alert for every misstroke of the quill, every errant drop of ink. A fussy man, a prim man for all his youth, a nag, a scold, a worrywart, just the sort of man to drive peasant borderers half insane. Now, as they stood by their guns, the Syrian gunners gave silent thanks for Eusebius and took comfort from his presence. The young twit was a pain in the ass, sure, but he was their pain in the ass.
"Knows his shit, Eusebius does," announced one.
"Best cannon man alive," agreed another.
Suddenly one of the wives laughed and cried out,
"Let's hear it for Eusebius. Come on, let's hear it."
Her call was taken up. An instant later, the entire contingent of gunners were shouting,
"Eusebius! Eusebius! Eusebius!"
Startled by the cheers, Eusebius stiffened. He knew that a commanding officer was supposed to give a speech on such occasions, a ringing peroration. Eusebius was no more capable of ringing perorations than a mouse was of flying. So, after a moment, he simply waved his hand and smiled, quite shyly, like the awkward young misfit he had been all his life. The smile was answered by grins on the faces of the Syrians. They were not disappointed by his silence. They knew the man well. Their overseer. Their pain in the ass. Above, on the poop deck, John of Rhodes smiled also. Not a shy, awkward smile, this. No, not at all. John of Rhodes was neither shy, nor awkward, nor a misfit. True, his former naval career had been shipwrecked by his incorrigible womanizing, but he had been universally recognized by his fellow officers, except perhaps those whose wives he had seduced, as the Roman Navy's finest ship captain. He knew a fighting crew when he saw one. And now, understanding that Eusebius would give no ringing peroration, could give none, John made good the lack. In his own way, of course. Pericles would have been aghast.
"Gunners, valiant men and women of the Theodoran cohort."
He leaned over the rail, pointing dramatically at the 7 Dromans some 300 yards distant.
"Those sorry bastards are fucked. Fucked!"
A loud and boisterous cheer went up from the gunners and their wives. Then, coming from far off, John heard a faint echo. Puzzled, he turned and stared at the causeway leading to the Pharos. The causeway was now lined with people. He could see more and more running down the Heptastadium coming from Alexandria. Residents of the city, he realized. The news had spread, and Alexandria's people were pouring out to watch the show. Alexandria's poor people, to be precise. Even at the distance, John could see that the men, women, and children on the causeway were dressed in simple clothing. Alexandria's busy harbor area was surrounded by slums. It was the occupants of those tenement buildings who had first gotten the word and were packing the Heptastadium, and he could see now, every other vantage point overlooking the great harbor and the sea. He grinned.
"Our people, those."
Aboard her flagship, Antonina came to the same conclusion. She had come out of her cabin as soon as the 4 captured officers had been securely bound and gagged. Hearing the distant cheers, she studied the crowd lining the Heptastadium. Then walked over to the starboard rail and stared at the Dromon rolling in the waves not far from her ship. After disembarking the 4 envoys, the Dromon had withdrawn some 30 yards and positioned itself facing her flagship. The oar banks were poised and ready for action. At the moment, they were simply being used to keep the Dromon in position, but it was obvious to Antonina that the Dromon would be able to ram her on an instant's notice. She would not give them that instant. She turned her head and called out for Euphronius. The commander of the Theodoran cohort immediately trotted over. Antonina gestured toward the nearby Dromon with her head.
"I want that ship obliterated. Can you do it?"
The young Syrian officer eyed the Dromon. A quick glance, no more.
"At that range?
Easily. Won't even need to use slings." "Do it," she commanded.
As Euphronius began to turn away, she restrained him with a hand.
"I want a hammer blow, Euphronius, not just a few grenades. If that Dromon can get up to ramming speed, it'll punch a hole right through the side of this ship."
Euphronius nodded. A moment later, using gestures and a hissing whisper, he was assembling his grenadiers amidships. The grenadiers Antonina saw would be invisible to the seamen manning the low-lying Dromon until they appeared at the rail itself tossing their grenades. Hermogenes came out of the cabin. Seeing the activity amidships, he hurried to her side.
"You're not going to give them any warning?" he asked. "Call on them to surrender?"
Antonina shook her head.
"I don't dare. That Dromon's too close.
If they have a warning, they might be able to ram us before the grenades do their work. And if they get close enough, the grenades will pose a danger to us. Thoughtfully, Hermogenes nodded. Good point. He stared out at the nearby warship. He could see several officers standing in the bow of the Drummen. They were close enough for their expressions to be quite visible. Frowns. They were worried, wondering what had happened to their envoys, beginning to get suspicious.
Fuck 'em, then, growled Hermogenes.
Antonina heard a low hiss. Turning, she saw that Euphronius had his grenadiers ready. At least 36 of them were poised, grenades in hand. Their wives stood immediately behind them, ready to light the fuses. The fuses had been cut very short. Casually, she gestured with her hand held waist high, waving the grenadiers forward.
Do it.
The wives lit the fuses. The Syrians charged for the rail, shouting their battle slogan.
For the Empire! The Empire!
The officers on the Drummen stiffened, hearing the sudden outcry. One of them opened his mouth, to shout an order, presumably. But his jaw simply dropped when he saw the mob of grenadiers appearing at the rail of the taller ship. He never said a word. Simply watched, agape, while the volley of grenades soared into the air. Then, along with all his fellow officers, crouched down and ducked. He must have thought the objects coming his way were stones. He never learned the truth. The 6 grenades which landed in the bow blew him into fragments along with the bow itself. Grenade explosions savaged the Drummen down its entire length. The warship's orientation, faced toward Antonina's flagship with its ram forward, was the worst possible position in which to avoid a grenade volley. Some of the grenades missed the ship entirely, falling into the water on either side. But in most cases, the grenadier's aim was true. And if one grenadier threw farther than another, it simply spread the havoc. The Drummen stretched almost 100 feet from bow to stern. Most of the grenadiers were easily capable of throwing a grenade across the 100 feet of water which separated Antonina's ship from the target. Most of them could reach halfway down the length of the craft, and some could heave their grenades all the way into the Drummen's stern. The grenades landed almost simultaneously and exploded within 3 seconds of each other. Dozens of bodies were hurled overboard. Precious few of the men who remained in the ship survived, and they primarily in the stern. The middle of the warship, where at least 12 grenades had landed in the midst of 200 men, was a mass of blood and shredded pieces of flesh. The warship's hull had been breached badly, outright holes or simply planks driven apart. The sea poured in, pulling the Drummen under the waves. Some of the surviving sailors began diving off the stern. Others, not knowing how to swim, simply watched their death approach, too stunned to even cry out in despair. Without turning her head, Antonina spoke to Hermogenes.
Rescue the ones you can, she commanded. Put them under guard in the hold.
Antonina's eyes searched for the other Drummens in the mouth of the harbor. The warships were stirring into motion. Already she could see the oar banks begin to flash. But after a moment, she realized that only 4 of the Drummens were heading toward her. The other 3 were moving to intercept the Theodora bearing down on them from the northwest. Trying to intercept the Theodora, that is to say. Even to Antonina's inexperienced eye, it was obvious that the gunship would pass across their bows with at least 100 yards of sea room.
I'm counting on you, John, she murmured. Smash up some of those Drummens for me.
On the Theodora, John was issuing new orders.
Ignore those 3 heading for us, Eusebius, he bellowed. Concentrate your fire on the ones heading for Antonina.
Eusebius didn't bother to look up. Preoccupied with helping a gun crew lay their cannon, he simply waved a hand in acknowledgement. Finally, satisfied with the work, he looked up at the enemy. Already they were crossing the bows of the 3 warships who had peeled off to intercept them. The nearest of those ships was 200 yards away, much too far to be able to get into ramming position, even given the greater speed of the Drummens. Eusebius turned his attention to the other 4 ships. The nearest of those was still 300 yards distant. Estimating the combined speed, Eusebius decided they would be within firing range in less than 2 minutes.
Fire on my command!
As always, Eusebius tried to copy John of Rhodes' commanding bellow. As always, the result was more of a screech. But he had been heard by all the gunners nonetheless. Again, he screeched,
No broadside! Fire each cannon as it bears on my command!
He scurried forward to the lead cannon.
For a moment, he almost pushed the chief gunner aside. Then, restraining himself, he took a position looking over his shoulder, sighting with the chief gunner down the barrel of the cannon. 250 yards now. 200. They would cross the nearest Drahman's bow with 100 yards to spare. Good range. Eusebius blocked everything from his mind but the Drahman looming ahead. As nearsighted as he was, the ship was not much more than a blur, but it didn't matter. His decision would be based on relative motion, not acute perception. He and the chief gunner moved aside so as not to get caught by the cannon's recoil. The effort didn't distract Eusebius' attention in the least. The moment came. He tapped the chief gunner lightly on top of his leather helmet.
"Fire," he said quite softly.
The cannon roared, bucked, recoiled. A cloud of gun smoke hit the target. But Eusebius wasn't looking at the target anyway. He was scampering down the line to the next cannon. By the time he got there, the chief gunner had already stepped aside, clearing a space for the cannon's recoil. He gave a quick, myopic look. Again, all he saw was a blur. Relative motion, all that mattered. He tapped the chief gunner's helmet.
Fire.
Down the line, next cannon. Blur. Relative motion, tap, fire. Down the line, next cannon. Blur, relative motion, tap, fire. Down the line, next cannon. Blur, blur. No motion. He looked up squinting. Suddenly the noise around him registered. Cheers. Syrian gunners cheering. Syrian wives shrieking triumph. And then, above it all, John of Rhodes' powerful bellow.
Oh, beautiful! Great work, Eusebius! She's nothing but a pile of kindling!
The chief gunner of the last cannon in line was grinning up at him.
That Drahman is still floating, he said. You want I should smash it up?
Eusebius shook his head.
No. Save it. There's more of them.
He squinted. Everything was a blur. He thought he could make out two ships clustered together, but years later the young artificer would look back on that moment and decide that was when he finally grew up. All his life he had been sensitive about his terrible eyesight, yet too proud, too shy also, to ask for help. Finally, he did.
I can't see very well, Chief Gunner, he admitted. Am I right?
Are the next two ships lying alongside each other? The Syrian's grin widened.
That they are, sir. Bastards almost collided, shying away from the gunfire. They did get their oars tangled.
Eusebius nodded, then straightened up and screeched.
Gunners, are the cannons reloaded?
Within seconds, a chorus of affirmative answers came.
Screech. Prepare for a broadside. Aim for those two ships. Fire on my command.
He leaned over, whispering.
Help me out, Chief Gunner. Tell me when you think...
Be just a bit, sir. Captain John's bringing the ship around to bear. Just a bit. Just a bit.
The Syrians study the enemy. Two Drahmans 100 yards away, just now getting their oars untangled. A fat, juicy target. He tapped Eusebius on the knee.
Do it now, sir, he murmured.
Immediately, Eusebius screeched,
Fire! All cannons fire! All cannons!
The rest was lost in the broadside's roar. When the smoke cleared away, a new round of cheers went up. True, the broadside hadn't inflicted as much damage as the earlier single gunfire had done to the first Drahman. It hardly mattered. The rams of war galleys were braced and buttressed, but the hulls of the ships themselves were made of thin planking for the sake of speed. Those hulls had never been designed to resist the impact of 5-inch diameter marble cannonballs. One of the warships had been holed in the bow. Not enough to sink it, but more than enough to send it scuttling painfully back to shore. As for the other, the bow was badly battered, though not holed. But one cannonball, by sheer good luck, must have caught the port side bank of oars just as they were lifting from the water. Many of those oars were shattered. What was worse, the impact had sent the oar butts flailing about in the interior of the galley, hammering dozens of rowers like so many giant mallets. Objectively speaking, the warship was still combat capable, but its crew had had more than enough of these terrible, weird weapons. That Drummond, too, began heading for the great harbor, yawing badly with only half a bag of oars on one side. On the poop deck, John was bellowing new commands. The four ships which had been heading for Antonina's flagship were effectively destroyed, one sinking, two fleeing, and the last floundering about with indecision. Antonina could handle that one on her own. John had his own problem now. The Rhodian brought the ship around to face the three Drummonds which had tried to intercept him earlier. The war galleys had chased after him, and with their superior speed were rapidly approaching. Not rapidly enough. By the time they got within range, John had brought the ship's port side to bear with its five unfired cannons and fresh gun crews. Eusebius was already there, prepared. John was a bit puzzled to see that the artificer had brought one of the chief gunners from the starboard battery along with him. He saw Eusebius and the man confer briefly. Then Eusebius's unmistakable screech. "Broadside! On my command!" John smiled. As he often had before, he found the young artificer's boyish voice comical. But this time there was not a trace of condescension in that smile. Comical, yes. Pathetic, no. Again he saw Eusebius and the chief gunner's heads bobbing in urgent discourse. The three Drummonds were 200 yards away, their oar banks flashing, their deadly rams aimed directly at the Theodora. Again the screech. "Fire! All cannons, fire! All—" Lost in the roar, a cloud of smoke obscuring the enemy. Screech. "Reload! Reload! Quick! Quick!" John watched the gun crews racing through the drill. He gave silent thanks for the endless hours of practice that Eusebius had forced through over the Syrians' bitter complaints. They weren't complaining now. Oh no, not at all. Just racing through the drill, shouting their slogan. "For the Empire! The Empire!" The smoke cleared enough for John to see the enemy. The three Drummonds were only 50 yards away now. He flinched. No way to stop them from ramming. Except, their forward motion had stopped, he realized. None of the ships were sinking, true. Only one of them, judging from appearance, had even suffered significant hull damage. Still, the shock had been enough to throw the rowers off their stroke. The men on those galleys were completely unprepared for the sound and fury of a cannon broadside. Instead of driving forward in the terrifying concentration of a war galley's ramming maneuver, the Drummonds were simply drifting. Again, the screech. "Fire! All cannons!" Lost in the roar. Cloud of smoke, enemy invisible. John leaned over the rail, ready to order. No need. Eusebius was already doing it. Screech. "Canister! Canister! Load with canister!" The smoke cleared, enough at least for John to see. One Drummond was sinking. Another had been battered badly. It was still afloat, but totally out of control. Yawing aside now, its deadly ram aiming at nothing but the empty Mediterranean. But the third ship was still coming in. Not driving for a ram, however, so much as clawing forward with broken oars and wounded rowers, desperately seeking to grapple. Anything to get away from that horrible hail of destruction. No use. John could see Eusebius at the middle cannon fussing over the gun crew. The Drummond was only 10 yards away, close enough for the artificer's myopic eyes. John saw Eusebius tap the gunner on his helmet. He saw his lips move, but couldn't hear the words. An instant later, the cannon belched smoke. Canister swept the length of the Drummond like a scythe. John of Rhodes was in no sense a squeamish man, but he couldn't help flinching at the sheer brutality which that round of canister inflicted on the Drummond's crew. Firing at point-blank range at a mass of men seated side by side on oar banks, one oar bank lined up after another. He shuddered. So Eusebius scampered down to the next cannon in line. Aim, tapped the gunner's helmet. Another roar, another round of canisters savaged the Drummond. Blood everywhere. Eusebius scampering. Aim, tap, fire. It was sheer murder now, pure slaughter. Eusebius scampering. John leaned over, bellowing, "Enough, Eusebius, enough!" The artificer, his hand raised just above the next gunner's helmet, ready to tap, looked up. Squinted nearsightedly at the poop deck. "Enough!" bellowed John. Slowly, Eusebius straightened. Slowly, he walked to the rail and leaned over. looked down into the hull of the Drummond, which was now bumping gently against the Theodora's side, studying for the first time, really, his handiwork. Under other circumstances, at another time, the artificer's Syrian gunners, country rubes, the lot of them, coarse fellows, would have derided him then, mocked and jeered, ridiculed and sneered at the sight of their commander Eusebius puking his guts into the sea. But not that day. Not then. Instead, Syrian gunners and their wives slowly gathered around him, the gunners patting him awkwardly on the shoulder as he vomited. And then, after he straightened, a plump Syrian wife held the sobbing young man in a warm embrace, ignoring the tears which soaked her homespun country garments. Above, on the poop deck, John sighed.
"Welcome to the club, lad. Murder is Rome."
He raised his head, scanning the sea. Victory. Total. 4 ships and their crews destroyed. 3 battered into a pulp. Nearly unscathed, Drummond racing away. He looked toward Antonina's flagship.
"She's all yours, girl. Alexandria is yours for the taking."
Aboard her flagship, Antonina studied the situation. Studied the pulverized enemy fleet first with satisfaction. Studied the wildly cheering mob on the Hepta Stadium next with equal satisfaction. Then, all satisfaction gone, she studied the city itself. Beyond the harbor, looming in the distance above the tenements and warehouses, she could see Pompey's Pillar. And not far away, the enormous Church of St. Michael. The Caesareum, that edifice had been called once, the Temple of Caesar. Its 2 great obelisks still stood before it. But the huge pagan structure, with its famous girdle of silver and gold pictures and statues, was now given over to the worship of Christ. And, of course, to the power of Christ's official spokesman. The patriarchs of Alexandria resided there, as they had for 200 years. 100 years after they took up residence, in the very street before the church, a brilliant female teacher of philosophy named Hypatia had been stripped naked and beaten to death by a mob of religious fanatics. "Fuck Alexandria," she hissed. Chapter 29. Supara, autumn, 531 AD. By the end of the first hour, Cujulo was complaining.
"What a muck. Gives me fond memories of Venandacatra's palace. Dry, clean."
Ahead of him, picking his way through the dense, water-soaked forest, Cungus snorted.
"We were there for 6 months. As I recall, you started complaining the first day. Too dull, you said. Boring. You didn't quit until we got pitched out of the palace to make room for the Empress's new guards."
Another Kushan, forcing his own way forward nearby, sneered.
"Then he started complaining about the new quarters. Too cramped, he said. Too drafty."
Cujulo grinned.
"I'm just more discriminating than you peasants, that's all. Cattle, cattle, munch their lives away, swiping flies with their tails. What—"
He broke off, muttering a curse, swiping at his own fly. Ahead, Cungus saw the small party of guides come to a halt at a fork in the trail. The 3 young Maratha woodcutters conferred with each other quickly. Then one of them trotted back toward the column of Kushan soldiers slogging through the forest. Watching, Cungus was impressed by the light and easy manner in which the woodcutter moved through the dense growth. The trail they had been following was nothing more than a convoluted serpentine series of relatively clear patches in the forest. The soil was soggy from weeks of heavy rain. The Kushans, encumbered with armor and gear, had made heavy going of the march. When the woodcutter reached Cungus, he pointed back up the trail and said, "That's it. Just the other side of that line of trees begins the hill leading to the fortress. You can go either right or left. There are trails." He stopped, staring at the strange-looking soldier standing in front of him. It was obvious the woodcutter was more than a little afraid of Cungus. Some of that fear was due to Cungus's appearance. The Maratha fishermen and woodcutters who inhabited the dense forest along the coast were isolated, for the most part, from the rest of India. Kushans, with their topknots and flat, step-harsh features, were quite unknown to them. But most of the young man's apprehension was due to more rational considerations. The woodcutter had good reason to be wary. Poor people in India, poor people in most lands for that matter, had long memories of the way soldiers generally treated such folk as they. The woodcutters had agreed to guide the Kushans to the fortress for two reasons only. First, money. Lots of money. A small fortune by their standards. Second, the magic name of the Empress Shakuntala. Even here in the remote coastal forest, the word had spread. Andhra lived still. Still, the Satavahana dynasty survived. For the woodcutter, Andhra was a misty, even semi-mythical notion. The Satavahanas, a name of legend rather than real life. Like most of India's poor, the woodcutter didn't consider politics part of his daily existence. Certainly not imperial politics. Yet, the new Malwa rulers were beasts. Cruel and rapacious. Everyone knew it. In truth, the woodcutter himself had no experience with the Malwa. Preoccupied with subjugating the Deccan, the Malwa hadn't bothered to send forces to the coast except for seizing the port of Supara. Isolated by the western Ghats, the sea-lying forests were of little interest to the Malwa. But the coast dwellers were Maratha, and the tales had spread. Tales of Malwa savagery, tales of Malwa greed and plunder, and, growing ever more legendary with the passing of time, tales of the serene and kindly rule of the Satavahanas. In actual fact, the woodcutter, for that matter the oldest great-grandfather of his village, had no personal memory of the methods of Satavahana sovereignty. The Satavahana dynasty had left the poor folk of the coast to their own devices, which was exactly the way those fishermen and woodcutters liked their rulers, far off and absent-minded, heard of but never seen. So, after much hesitation and haggling, the young woodcutters had agreed to guide Kungus and his men to the fortress. They hadn't inquired as to Kungus's purpose in seeking that fearsome place. Their work was done. Now the woodcutter waited apprehensively. Would he be paid the amount still owing, or... Kungus was a hard, hard man. Hard as stone in most ways, but he was in no sense cruel. So he wasn't even tempted to cheat the woodcutter or toy with the man's fears. He simply dipped into his purse and handed over 3 small coins. A huge smile lit up the woodcutter's face.